My guest today has 60 million books in print worldwide. He's a consistent number one bestseller in America, a superstar in France and Germany, and a top 10 bestseller in hardcover and paperback here in the UK. He's been translated into 43 languages. His essays and columns appear in many prestigious publications. He's won numerous awards. He has a film in production in Hollywood, a TV series being made in France, a major drama about to be screened here in the UK, and Julia Roberts has just announced she plans to both produce and star in the movie adaptation of his latest book. Harlan Coben, welcome to Meet the Writers. What was it, Harlan, just to start, about your college? You are not the only world-class writer come out of there at roughly the same time. Was it a particularly inspiring class or a teacher or something in the water?
I think it's something in the water. There was only 400 kids a grade. And my freshman year, I lived next door to David Foster Wallace. And my fraternity brother was a guy named Dan Brown who wrote The Da Vinci Code. So I'm not even the best-selling author in my own college fraternity. I think some were top 10 or 20 worldwide, but not even the biggest in my own fraternity. So we had a lot of Chris Bojalian, who wrote Midwives, and Mark Costello, and Bill Amond and Susanna Grant, all were there. We were all there in the early to mid-80s, and I can't explain it. I mean, it wasn't like we took the same classes or even knew each other all that well. So something about that time period at Amherst College did it.
Well, Dan Brown, now, the literary community, if you like, are a bit sniffy about his work, and I guess about mass-selling authors like you. Why do you think that is, and does it bother you?
It doesn't bother. I mean, look, any writer who says it doesn't bother them is lying. I mean, every writer you've ever had in here cares about two things. They want to have more sales, and they want to have more critical acclaim. That's life in general. To pretend otherwise is silly. It doesn't keep me up at night. It doesn't really bother me anymore or anything like that. And most of the critics who feel sniffy of you, as you put it, are the more unsuccessful ones. I mean, David Foster Wallace always read me, and we always got along wonderfully, both professionally and personally. And I'm friends with Michael Chabon and a number of great literary writers, and we all have mutual respect. I usually find it says more about the person who feels that way, that it's more about their own shortcomings than mine.
I'm really interested in the anatomy of a bestseller. I mean, obviously, it's got to be a good book in the first place. If it's rubbish, nobody's going to want to read it, however well you sell it. But is it a carefully calibrated art from the timing of the release to the way that the books are catalogued? And can you talk me through that process?
Yeah, I don't really know it all that well, to be honest. From my standpoint, I just try to write the best novel I can. My sensibilities may be commercial or may not be. I like to think that the books are, they're page turners, and I want this book. You know, One Fool Me Once to be the book that you take to bed at 10 o'clock at night and say, I'm just going to read for 15 minutes, and next thing you know, it's 4 in the morning. But I want to do, I hope I do it with heart, with characters, and with soul. Yeah, there's a lot of twists and turns, but if they don't have an emotional impact, if the ending of Fool Me Once or the TV show The Five doesn't make you almost or shed a tear, then I haven't really done my job. I need, at this stage of the game, I can stir your pulse, I can stir your mind, but the key for me is stirring your heart. And if I don't do that, it's not successful for me.
Well, it is extraordinary because you, as you say, you set out to manipulate human emotion and you succeed.
Yeah, well, manipulate's a tough word, but I want the story. I want the story to move you. I mean, manipulation, I'm not that calculating, you know. That's sort of what's the formula? I wish I knew the formula. Each book is harder than the one before to write, and it never gets easier. You're always insecure. You always think you stink. That's just part of writing. Only bad writers think they're good. You've had a lot of writers on this show. If a writer comes in here and says, yeah, my book's terrific, I'm terrific, trust me, they stink. If they really believe it, they may be lying. All writers have that sort of insecurity that feeds us, I think.
Even when you get to your stage.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've written 28 novels, and I still, every book, I'm like, oh, I lost it. I'm never going to have it again. And then 5 minutes later, oh, my God, this is so great. The last book wasn't. You know, it goes on constantly. I think when it stops is probably when you become that writer who starts to phone it in.
Yeah. Do you get a sense of Harlan Coben, the brand?
Do I have a sense of it? If there's a brand, I'm hoping it's just something, you know, like I say, novels of immersion, the book you take on vacation to Saint-Tropez, but you'd rather stay in your hotel room, because you have to know and Fool Me Once what happened to Maya and Shane and Joe and all the rest of the characters. But other than that, I don't really see it that much. I mean, I'm not naive to it, but I've found that as a writer, whenever things go a little crazy, whenever I worry about the industry, whenever I worry are ebooks taking over, bookstores closing a lot, I kind of stick my fingers in my ears and go, la, 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 I can hear you. I just try to write the best book I can because I found, one, as for a writer out there, it's the only thing you can control is how good your book is. And two, this may be Pollyanna, but I do believe if your book is good, people are going to find it one way or the other. And they may read it on stone tablets, you know, whatever it's going to be. If I do the best job I can to write the best book that I can, everything else will kind of fall into place. So I don't pay much attention to the, you know, the new trends in the industry and if people are doing audio or ebook or whatever it is. I just try to write the best book I can.
You've produced, as you say, a huge body of work, roughly divided between mysteries and thrillers. What's the difference?
I don't know. I mean, I have a series, a Myron Bolitar series, I guess some people classify as mystery, though I think they're as much thriller as the other ones, and I don't really know the difference. You know, mystery has a connotation, I think, that sort of relates to maybe Agatha Christie or something more, you know, locked rooms, puzzles, and I don't write that at all. But I'm not the one to categorize the books. To me, most of them, the standalones especially, are sort of family novels that have a crime in them. I mean, where something is, the pressure is applied, and that's how you get into the story, which is not necessarily a new tradition. It's been done since, you know, Shakespeare and Dostoevsky. So I don't know, not that we are in the same grouping, but my point is I don't really know how people categorize them or why.
And in terms of writing a series or a standalone, mm-hmm. is that a different process?
No. I mean, it's sort of like if you're a painter, when you're doing a standalone, it's a completely blank canvas. And when you do the series, it's as though it's a painting in progress. So some of it's already done, which helps, but that also presents challenges because you can't go back and start over again or paint over. But I find the process is pretty much the same. They're equally hard. I do know who my lead character is, so I know the voice a little better. But also, it's a challenge because I've written Myron now. I'm writing one right now. And it's the 11th novel, and I've been writing him since the first one came out in the early to mid-90s. So he was maybe 28 then. I've aged him, so he's in his 40s now. He has changed and aged, and all the other characters have too. And what was kind of funny or amusing or cutting edge back in 1994 is not cutting edge in 2016. So, you know, it's like an ongoing saga for me, which I really love. Each book is a chapter in a larger book that I don't know when I'll finish.
Do you ever get the plots confused?
I don't know. If I do, I'm confused enough to not know. I only do one at a time in terms of novels. With the TV shows and things like that, those I can do more than one at a time. But with the novels, it has to be only one. And when I'm done, I'm an empty vessel. So I don't think so. I don't think I've confused. Mm.
You're really well known for having these incredible twists. Do you always know what the twist's going to be when you start the book?
I know the last twist. I know the beginning and I know the end. So if you read Fool Me Once, and I think Fool Me Once probably has my biggest twist in the end, I think.
It's shocking. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay,
it's absolutely shocking, that twist, though.
So I knew that twist before I started. But all the other twists in the middle involving a lot of different things, which we won't discuss, most of them I did not know until I started to write the book. So I know it's sort of like a travel journey. So I know where I'm starting off. I know where I'm going to end up, but I don't know if I'm going to take a direct route. I don't know if I'm going to go via Tokyo or stop at via the Suez Canal or whatever. But I always pretty much end up at my final destination.
Which is something in this particular book that is never done in literary ways, usually.
I hope. It was a nerve-wracking process writing Fool Me Once because it all hinges, not just that the ending is a surprise, but that the ending works emotionally. Again, I could fool you and I could do it by sleight of hand, but I want that ending to also move you.
Yeah, well, it certainly does that. I wonder if it does that worldwide, in that you're published all over the world. And I wonder if you have a particular reader in your head and if they are a particular nationality or even a gender.
I don't. I don't even know who I try. You know, it's not necessarily even trying to please anybody. What I found is that I kind of have to be true to myself. I hate that expression, but it's sort of true. I find the more specific I am, the more universal the appeal. If all of a sudden I say, oh, you know what? My sales are down in Thailand. I better throw in a Thai character. I'm dead. The more I try to worry about what the audience wants, you know, dealing with this TV stuff that I've been dealing with, there's a lot of things where they do surveys and audience response. I ignore it all. Because part of your job as a writer or a creator of a TV show is to take the reader where he doesn't know he wants to go. And if my sensibilities aren't good with that, then I'm not a writer. Mm-hmm. So I have to sort of do it by what I think is going to work, not what I, to please a market share or anything like that.
Who's your first reader and how much influence does he or she have?
My first reader is my wife, and almost none. Her job is to tell me it's brilliant so I can keep writing. I mean, it's just been that way for you. Oh, no, honey, it's great. Really? Is it great? Yeah. Because if I hear any sort of criticism midway through or whatever, I get paralyzed. Because like I say, I'm insecure like everybody else. Because my editors and my publishers get nervous. I usually send them like about the first 100 pages. And if they have a criticism, they've never given it. They know that it's probably better. I said, unless there's something really wrong or you really don't like it, just sort of say something nice. So I keep on this role that I'm going on. So later on, I'll listen to writers. Again, a writer, this is one of the things, it's great to get feedback. And a lot of people out there are members of writing groups. And if that's making you write, terrific. But at the end of the day, if you don't know what works, you're really not going to have too much success. That's not to say I don't listen to editors and criticism. I do. But if you don't have a feel for how it's working, you're probably in trouble.
Mm. Now, Fool Me Once starts with a funeral, and one of the lines is that people never die completely. And I wondered about your views about life after death.
Well, I'm haunted by those who I've had my own share of tragedy, like everybody else in life. I lost my parents at a fairly young. They were fairly young. And so they never quite leave my mind, and they always linger there, and their echo is in me and in my children. And I think about that sort of thing often. Not so much of life after death. I'm not a religious fellow. But, in a corny way, love lingers. Death is really final, which is why I love to have missing people in books, because you don't know if they're dead or alive. But there's something that lingers about it. There's something haunting.
Now, Maya, the main character in Fool Me Once, is a pilot, a military pilot. And at one point, she says that war changes how you see things. And the military experience in the book is very, very finely drawn. And I wondered if you'd experienced that.
I've never been in the military. One of the misconceptions about writing is that you have to actually experience it yourself. But, if you have to have an imagination, the lead character is female. I'm not. and I'm in her head the whole book. I was fortunate enough a couple of years ago to go on a USO tour of military bases in the Middle East, actually one up in northern England and one in Germany and Walter Reed Hospital in D.C., where USO was the group that you used to see old things of Bob Hope and Marilyn Monroe visiting to entertain the troops. And I always think, those troops had Marilyn Monroe, these troops get me. We really aren't treating our veterans well. But I went there to talk to the soldiers about books, sign some books for them, talk to them about writing. It was a very powerful experience. And, talking to a lot of them, meeting a lot of them, I realized that a lot of the cliches that we think about soldiers aren't true. And I got a lot of it out of the conversations that I've had with them before and since. And then I met a female military pilot who had flown in combat, one of the first. And she was just incredible. Nothing like Maya. She's actually really outgoing and gregarious. But I ended up speaking to, I think, 4 female military combat veterans, and none of them wanted me to put their name in the acknowledgement. They all asked me just to mention the other soldiers who are out there and suffering. Mm. And that's the kind of people that they are.
And empathy, there was a lot of empathy for where they were coming from. And one of the lines that really struck me, that it was, war is never a meritocracy for casualties.
Yeah, it's not. It's not like the best soldiers live and the worst soldiers die. It's extraordinarily random, and chaos theory is all over the place. Nothing ever goes as planned in war. Mm-hmm. And that's just something that pretty much any soldier who's gone over there realizes right away.
You address the gun debate, the right to bear arms, and the very visceral response that people have to that on either side of the debate. What's your view?
Oh, I'm not giving my view. it's not my job to. I don't want people to go into the book thinking he's a right-wing wacko, he's a left-wing nut. I really don't. Yeah. I love to present the arguments. And you were mentioning before empathy, which is the most important thing a writer has. And there's a big difference between empathy and sympathy. Sympathy implies you're sort of a good person. I'm not sure we're good people, but you have to have empathy in the sense that I have to be able to get into everybody's head and be able to see their viewpoint. So if I'm anti-gun or pro-gun, I have to have the ability to go into the head of a person who believes either one and be able to articulate that equally. And so I've never been in war, but I have to be able to empathize with people who have, not necessarily sympathize, which is a difference, empathize and get in that person's head. And so I love to raise these topics. I love to take a strange middle ground. I love to show the hypocrisy on both sides, but I don't like to give an answer. That's just not my job.
Well, and in terms of getting into people's head, you talk about the mommy world, as you call it, and it seems very, very real. And I wondered if you're a hands-on parent to your four kids.
I live in a town that's really a lot of what we call helicopter parenting. I don't know if they have that expression here in England where the parents are around the kids all the time. And I don't want to say I'm above it because that's not fair. But I will say that my wife and I are probably two of the more mellow parents in town. I mean, we don't keep an eye on their homework. We don't check. There's a computer we can check. I don't even know how to sign into that computer that can check where the classes are online. And part of that's probably laziness as well as my own parenting philosophy of trying in this very protective cocoon to let them every once in a while make mistakes. Parenting is not for the faint of heart. Parenting does not come with a instruction manual. All parents screw up, and all parents feel like they're screw-ups. That's part of the experience.
What seems great to me, though, in this book is that you are looking at a lot of things from, obviously, the lead character is female, but you seem to really be able to get into that point of view. And at one point, you address the sexist language of war that civilians killed. People say a mother. People never say a father's been killed.
Right. They never do. They always say, when a mother has been killed. There's sexism in both ways on that scale. But yeah, there's a definite sexism in a lot of the language that's used because it's always right. The tragedy of a mother being killed. You never hear the tragedy of a father being killed. Little things like that people were pointing out to me when I was over.
You also write about the addictive element to fear. And I wondered if, obviously, that's something that we feel as we're reading your books too. I wondered if there was something or what it was that particularly frightens you.
I don't know it frightens me. I think that these books, in a sense, work as a strange kind of therapy for me, where I am not a fearful person outwardly. I block a lot, I think. And I may get them out this way. So I, what I found interesting was that people, yes, it scars you, war and things like that. And this is where I love to, where everything is so counterintuitive. And yet, so many of the soldiers that I met were dying to get back into the fight. In many ways, the heroic way, they really just wanted, they felt like they had abandoned their fellow soldiers who were still in war zones. But there was, many of them confessed to me, sort of, there's an addictive quality. If you're living a sort of very normal life, they come home, they're living on a farm, they're just doing regular chores, and life can be dull. And here, your adrenaline was rushed so much. Mm. That's what drugs do. Mm. I mean, there is that side of it. I love to take the other side. And in the case of we were mentioning the mommies, Maya is not a warm, fuzzy, maternal type. I've written those types before. Maya is not that. Maya is a little cold and a little standoffish sometimes with her own child. She wants to be warmer, but that's just not her personality. And yet I think that maybe she's the best mother I've written. So it's always interesting to play with what is counterintuitive.
No, she's so real, isn't she? Because no mother really feels like that. 100%.
Right. But in the books, you always do. Like, you're taught as a mother. This is what drives me crazy about society. You are sort of taught as a mother that you playing on the floor with your little two-year-old, you should love every moment of it. And let's face it, after a few minutes, that gets boring.
Exactly.
And it's okay to admit that. But mothers are like afraid to admit that. So Maya is not. Maya is just like, yeah, this is great. And then it's boring. And then other mothers will shame her for that kind of a thing. It's an interesting dilemma that goes on.
Yeah, very, very interesting. There are lots and lots of topical references in the book, even if the actual events or the people aren't completely pinned down. So, for instance, the Ashley Madison affair is referenced.
Yeah.
There's also a WikiLeaks Julian Assange-like character.
Yeah.
And in reference to that, you talk about the everything out in the open utopia. Is that something that you subscribe to?
Again, I'm not going to give my own opinion on it, but I will point out that what's interesting about that particular character, and think about Julian Assange, is he has his own secrets. He doesn't want people to know how he does it and why. Well, his thing's a little bit above it. Groups by nature, there's a danger in any sort of, I think, group where we are, and be it a religion, be it scouting things, be it a school, where people are more interested in protecting, it's the ends justify the means. They're more interested in protecting that group than they are in doing what's right. So you cover things up because you want to protect. But so, frankly, does the organizations that out them. They want to have their own secrets. So I love to point out the hypocrisy of both. I don't know what the utopia would be. That's not my job to figure out. I just make stuff up for a living.
Let's move on to TV and film adaptations. Yeah. It seemed to come quite late in your writing career. Why was that?
Well, for the most part, what I've done is I've optioned off the books. I haven't got at all involved in the Hollywood or the, be it France or England, the process. I was happy writing novels, and I was warned very early on by a very wise editor who pointed out a lot of best-selling authors who kind of exploded out, and then they went to Hollywood, and they forgot to write their books, and now you don't know who they are anymore. Mm. And so I have a real healthy fear of Hollywood. And so I'd gone out there a couple of times early on and did not like the experience. So I would just sell them and say, yeah, I'm trying to make it. And either they wouldn't be able to make it, or they would just because they're forgetful, or they would start making it a way I didn't like, and then I would try to sabotage it. So I didn't get very much made. And then about, you know, I had one great experience, the book called Tell No One, which was a French movie that Guillaume Canet made. It was a did a tremendous business worldwide, and he, you know, I give Guillaume a lot of credit as a director, and we had a great time making it. And then more recently, as I've written this many novels, and TV has gotten so good right now, there's so many great things on TV, that I said this might be a time that I'm more interested now in doing it. I've written 28 novels, and I'm ready to try something different. And one of the early examples was when Nicholas Schindler, who runs Red Productions here in Britain, and they've done Happy Valley, they've done Queer as Folk, Scott and Bailey, Last Tango in Halifax, just wonderful, wonderful shows. And I had this idea for a TV series that I was thinking of writing as a novel, but I kind of wanted to see what would happen if I went right to TV with it, if I made a novel, a TV show, if you will. And so Nicol and I hooked up, and Sky One is now going to be showing The Five.
Which is just brilliant. I started watching a tiny taster of it. Hours later, I was still absolutely glued to it.
Thank you.
It seems particularly British, though. And, of course, you're an American writer. Yeah. So tell me about that process.
Well, the story is really American, I guess. But it was fun. This is part of the fun of, you know, collaborating, is that we turned it British. I remember having the people over, and I showed them the New Jersey locations, New York, New Jersey locations where I live, where I was thinking the story would take place. But I said, now you have to find me the British equivalents. And they did, and in a brilliant kind of a way. So it's a real hybrid. It's a real American kind of fast-paced story about these four friends who are going through this, reliving this tragedy from their youth, but with a real British sensibility, and the mix has been really kind of fun.
How involved do you get? I know earlier you said that you weren't particularly hands-on, but with things like, I mean, I was really noticing that the music, the casting, all of it just seemed so spot on, and I wondered how much actually you contributed to that.
This was a lot. I was hands-on a lot. I mean, because in the past I hadn't been. That was the whole idea. I was executive producer and creator. I watched probably, I don't know, 200-300 audition tapes. I was involved in the casting, picking a director. I saw every day they sent me the rushes to watch, and I watched them and commented on them. The whole story, you know, I worked on the whole story with the screenwriters. I was involved pretty much in every aspect. It was a real team effort. We had a wonderful director named Mark Condrai do all 10 episodes. It has a real visual feel, doesn't it? I mean, from the moment you see that red sweatshirt, that very first scene, we wanted to make it look very cinematic. We didn't want to make it look too British in the sense that I didn't want like rain or trench coats or grays, this bright color that just jump out at you. And so it's a little bit of an electric feel. The music, Mark Condrai, the director, was a DJ for many years. And he really found just perfect songs that just bring it all out and give it an edge. The cast is young. They're not all that well known. I think they soon will be. Tom Cullen, most people know from Downton Abbey. Sarah Soleimani from Him and Her. Lee Ingleby from Inspector George Gently. And O.T. Fagbenle, who was just on The Interceptors on BBC. Those are our four leads. And they're all young. They're all terrific. I think all of them are going to be huge names. And then you add in some wonderful British actors like Geraldine James, who's a legend, you know, and Michael Maloney and Don Warrington as the parents in the story. And it was just a wonderful mix. I'm so lucky that I was able to do this.
That's an absolutely brilliant series.
Thank you.
Now, Julia Roberts, big news from Hollywood. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Julia Roberts read Fool Me Once, and she, you know, this is because the book just came out, and she had read it right before it came out, I guess. I think I spoke to her on the Monday after the book came out, and I think she'd be a great Maya. And she wants to make it. She wants to, you know, so we're going to try to set it up where that, you know, Julia Roberts stars as Maya in Fool Me Once. That's where we are now.
But quite unusually, I mean, she wants to produce it herself, too. Yeah. She's that into it that she is determined to get it made.
Well, it was really flattering. You hear a lot of, like I say, a lot of baloney from Hollywood, so I always listen with half an ear. So I think my agent sent the book out like on a Wednesday, and by Thursday afternoon, they had called and they said, well, you know, I think Julia Roberts is reading it and she's interested. And I hear this sort of thing in one way or another all the time, so I didn't pay much attention. And the next day, they said, she's finished the book. She wants to talk to you on Monday. I'm like, well, yeah, I can fit that in my schedule. Yeah, I can fit talking to Julia Roberts in my schedule. And when I spoke to her, she was so insightful, so passionate, had really not only read the book, but really got it carefully and noticed things that I'd put in toward the end that made the ending inevitable and the cycles. And it was just fascinating to hear her take on it. I was just, you know, I was like, wow, this is really cool. So let's do it.
So with all of this other stuff going on, where do you fit in your writing?
Anywhere. I'm not one that has to be in one certain spot to write. I can write any place. And in the end of the day, whenever this sounds so great, right? But it's also kind of crazy. And I'm a person who needs my alone time. So, you know, after this trip I'll be taking doing all this promotion for The Five and Fool Me Once, I'll run home and I'll just need to lock myself in a room and write. And I do it. I wrote on the airplane over here. Yesterday it was a beautiful day in London and I sat outside. I had a spare hour before I had to do some interviews and I came out with my notebook. The secret of writing is to write. You know, you don't need 8 hours alone sitting in a certain corner. You have to find the time and make the time. But also, I think about it all the time. I'm lousy company. I get distracted. My friends kind of know it. I look off and just go, oh, Harlan's going to La La Land again. You know, they know. And then I'm thinking of ideas. And then so I have the story worked out in my head and the actual time writing it becomes less.
Harlan Coben, amazing writer, fabulous book. Fool Me Once is out now. The Five, screened on Sky One every Friday. And there's a new book coming.
I hope so. In the fall, I hope to bring back my series character, Myron Bolitar.
Well, we all look forward to that much indeed. Thank you for being on Meet the Writers.
Thanks.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Nina Norick. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.